At the beginning of our practice of hearing the call to release this week, right at the beginning, at the first time that we gathered to learn, we spoke about convening a space to dig deeper together, to search for meaning. In Hebrew, this is called a bet midrash. Let's say that together. Bet midrash. Bet midrash. A house for study. However, as noted, the Hebrew word, midrash, which is actually also the name that is given to many commentaries on the Torah text itself, really means to search. It's the act of searching. Darash. It means to seek. So it's really a space for seeking. So it is really the difference between a house and a home. You can have all the house you want, and there is no home there. There is all the bet midrash that you want, but there is no seeking there. And so the rabbis of the early rabbinic era convened houses for study, but not in houses, not in spaces, but in gardens, in courtyards, in any place that could be a place for the searching for meaning. It was portable. And they borrow deeply from the Torah text that speaks about the tabernacle, the Mishkan, in the wilderness. And in that text, in the text of the going into the wilderness, at a certain point, the Israelites are seeking a place for the divine to rest within them. And the story goes that there are many gifts, gold and silver and tapestries and what have you. But it is only when the Spirit rests within that place. But the text says in Hebrew, "And they shall make for me a sanctuary, and I shall dwell among them." Says Rashi, Rabbi Solomon ibn Tzachi, who lived in Troyes, who is one of the heir to the rabbinic way. He lived in the 11th century. He was the generation before Maimonides. The acronym is Rashi. He was a Vintia, actually, by profession. And he wrote a commentary to the Torah text that is beloved by Jewish communities through the generations up to this day. And he asks the question that we must live now. What is the question? Why does it say among them? They shall make for me a sanctuary, and I shall dwell within it. Rashi says, so it is that when people make a space for the divine within them, the divine is able to rest. And therefore, it matters not the size, the scope of the sanctuary that is created, although this is a fabulous room. This is a fabulous room to be in for learning. It is what happens within us, what moves within us in the teaching that is most important. So let's carry that teaching with us through today, because we're about to enter into a different space. A space that is not known often as a mikdash, as a sanctuary. And that space is a museum. Yeah. See, I got the fast track to the cappuccino. But what you notice, what I notice deeply, to use a phrase, about museums is the line for the coffee cart or the line at the cafe. It seems to me, and maybe your experience is different to mine, but this was my experience for many years, that especially the larger museums that one goes to, you go inside the museum, and maybe you have a map with you, maybe you're given a map by an attendant. These places are often vast, not always. The museum we're going to enter into is pretty darn vast. You're not going to see it in a whole day. So what are you going to do? Traverse 2 millennia worth of art in 2 hours or half a day? Oh my word. But that is exactly what people do! Hello, people! Like, you're literally going to walk through 2,000 years of history in 2 hours. Okay. Good luck with that one. So, you know, I overhear conversations. I want to go to see European paintings. No, I want to go and see iconography. No, okay, and finally they go their merry ways. But there's a very interesting moment when people are walking into a museum and choosing. We've heard from other faculty here about the power of choice. Attention and intention. I was just in Felicia's meditation this morning at 9 o'clock, and we understood that thinking carefully about these words, attention and intention. I can be present, I can show up for an activity, but then what's my intention with that activity? What am I seeking to gain? And it looks to me, from many museum experiences that I've been a part of often, is there's a traipsing, often with our digital friends in tow, and you know, we have them out and we snap and we take and we maybe spend like a minute, that's a long time, in front of a painting, a sculpture, what have you, and then we move on. Often there's the urge to go to that little white thing next to the painting and find out what the curator thought about this. And then other times you hear, and they do so in a very well-meaning way, individuals who are speaking about the works of art and people are coming with them, but the language they're using is inaccessible to many. The language is quoting from this person and that person and referencing this movement and that movement, but doesn't really talk about the painter's experience or the sculptor's experience or sometimes some of the narratives and stories that underpin that particular work. and sometimes they are very challenging and charged. The museum itself is a place of great privilege. And the narratives that go into what it means to have a museum in a city and what it means for a nation to build museum collections, let alone private collections of art, is a conversation, but it's for another time. We're going to recognize that at the beginning of our journey together, but we're not going to go into those narratives together today. But we're going to hold them close as we walk towards the artworks that we're going to see. Because walking into a place of privilege in this way can be deeply alienating. Knowing where some of the artworks came from and how they arrived there and got there, huge fan of the British Museum, are also deeply troubling and challenging. And what is it to bring a family experience into a museum? So I'd like to start with the experience that I shared right at the beginning. This is Waddesdon Manor. This is the country seat of the Rothschilds, where as a 9-year-old, I ran up this pathway and through this door over here. The rose garden is to the right and round the back, but this is what it looks like. I did tell you Downton Abbey, but Downton Abbey is a bit, it's a bit. This is a neo-Gothic pile here. And neo-Gothic, there we are, first time. What's that word, neo-Gothic? But a person just says it like it's, you know, oh, the neo-Gothic movement. So I'm not going to be doing that today. There won't be any of these phrases, there won't be any jargonese. I'm just going to ask us to put aside those phrases. We might be inclined, when we speak to one another, to reference impressionism, right? Fauvism, and so on. I'm just going to say, if that comes up for us, these phrases, these words that we get to hang it on, let's just put them to the side and just notice what we're seeing without contextualizing, okay? So that's the second thing I'd like to say. We're not going to be contextualizing within art within certain movements. We're also not going to be making art today. So when the phrase here in the call to release, a journey in text, art, and imagination, the art part of it is looking at art and seeing what art does when we look at it, see it through our eyes. And here are the stairs today. These are the stairs that I ran up. Aren't they great? Which 9-year-old wouldn't want to run up these stairs? But now, when I went back with my boys, but now they have this. They didn't have this. Then, which basically says, don't even think about running up these stairs. Okay. The tapestry is not there anymore, so I can't show it to you. When I went back, it's no longer, and I can't find it online. So it's lost to me. I never got the artist. I didn't go looking for it. So I have in my, it was a medieval hunting scene, and I know what it looks like, but I can't find it anymore. Actually, that's probably a good thing, though, right? Because it means that it's there for me, and I have to articulate it. I can't just rely on Google to reveal it to you. So it's an experience of mine, and I hope that some of you in this room will have had experiences of works of art, or just an experience with art that has been meaningful for you. And that, therefore, is our first activity this morning. I hope that you will have had passing round the little name tags, because some people have said it's very helpful when speaking with someone else to remember the name and to call them into that space by name. So please, if you don't have a name tag, the name tags should be going round or have been going round. Just if you have a whole thing of name tags, please could you just raise your hand, because I couldn't quite find it. Has anyone got the name tag sheet? Beautiful. If it's still going round with a pen, Please pass it around, and we'll pass it upstairs as well. Thank you. So I'm going to ask you to be in chavruta pairs. So that's another word that we learned. Let's say it again. Chavruta. Chavruta. Chavruta is a study buddy. Okay, it's a study part. It's a study partnership. The learning is there not to play I'm right, let's catch up. That's not interesting. Instead, the learning is to inquire. Midrash. There's that word again, darash, to seek together, okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to take 7 minutes, and what I'm going to ask is the following prompt. Question, hands up those who've been in a museum, small, large. Okay, that may not be every hand. So, please borrow from the following experiences. Either you're having gone into a museum in your life, having gone into an experience, an educational experience of any kind, really, where you were walking in and looking to learn from something or someone, okay? Or an experience of going into nature, going to a certain place in nature with a goal of being in that place and of experiencing what that place reveals to you, okay? So those are the three different. If you can reach into an experience of going to a museum, and it can be from being a child all the way up to the present day, please go with that. If that's not readily accessible to you, then please borrow from either an educational experience or from an experience of going into nature with the goal of learning something about that place or about a body of knowledge. For those that are digging into the experience of being in a museum, let's just sit with that for a second. How old were you? Who were you with? What was the purpose of you being there? Which museum was it? What happened when you walked in? And if that's not readily accessible, do you remember going somewhere that made an impact? A room, an item, a work of art, a conversation, an exchange, a moment in time in that museum which you remember and you can recall today? Perhaps vividly so, maybe less so. For those that are going into the educational experience or the world of nature, what was your purpose in going into that experience? Why did you want to be there? Was anyone with you? Do you remember something about that experience? Now, because I'm asking you to share, I'm going to ask you to be present in that sharing. So if there's something that was not quite right to share with someone you don't really know, don't use it. Use another experience. So this is an experience of sharing, being present to sharing. So only bring an experience, vocalize an experience, if you feel comfortable to do so. Unreasonable request, don't sit this one out. That's the unreasonable request of the day. Okay, please don't sit this one out. Okay? That means you can sit with, you can say, you know what, it's 10:30 in the morning, I haven't had my cappuccino, I'm not really up for talking right now. That's absolutely fine, if that's what it is. But show up for that other person, be generous, ask questions. Make it clear from the beginning. I'm with you, I'm here, I'm just not going to be sharing this morning. However, I'm curious about your experience, okay? Any clarifying questions about that activity? Okay, so please find someone who you have not, if you can, who you either have not met before or you don't know that well. Okay, 7 minutes. And if threes are necessary, then it's threes, all right? So no one should be without an experience. Mr. Yazoo. We're going to scan from Kathy to Jim, as we have done in prior learning opportunities together, just for what does that experience feel like to you, is the prompt. Okay, so we're not talking about the content, we're talking about what we actually shared, we're talking about the experience for ourselves of being in that conversation, for 7 minutes. And as before, the scanning is really just if anything's arising for you that you want to share into the group.
The power of that experience of being present to each other's pretty profound experiences.
The power of that experience of being present to each other's
feelings.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Observations.
Mm-hmm. Scott?
I actually, when I was listening to John speak, how he focused in on one or two exhibits that had a really big impact on him and seeing what museum is supposed to do, not only educate, but to have us find interest into what dive into those interests specifically.
And by the way, because of our masks and because of the space, I'll just ask us to, if we can enunciate, because it's hard sometimes to hear. Thank you, Scott. Okay. Yes.
I identify with my partner's experience of saying, gosh, I don't necessarily know enough about art appreciation to like these paintings, but connecting with different items that connect me to an object or to a person or to a past experience. And I appreciate that.
Oh, yes.
I could understand the person's personal experience best when they explained their emotional response to what they saw. At the very beginning of their description, I was peering through a dark corridor as they explained their feelings and what they took away from viewing the object. The view got brighter and bigger.
Thank you. Oh. Yes.
I got a sense of my partner's sort of what he was born with, this interest in things at work and genetics. And so I felt like I not only heard about the experience, but who he was as a human being.
You got at who he was as a human being through the prism of the experience that was sharing. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
And we found that some of the things we knew we were really touched, but it was hard to articulate it. The art brought something out, but it was still hard to say a language word with it. Of why it touched us.
So you knew that there was a knowledge that it did touch, but it was hard to articulate the why?
Yes.
Oh, okay, thank you, yes.
Well, personally, for me, it was joy in remembering what I saw.
It was joy in remembering what you saw. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was the one that was like, I'm going to pass and sit this one out. And you just called me out. So I was like, okay, yeah, let me participate, of course. But as we spoke, I so just appreciate listening to the story and voice of another and making connections with the story in the voice of another. And I'm like, oh my goodness, the more that we chatted, the more that we were connected in a way through story. But right before you passed the symbols, my partner and I discovered, oh my goodness, that not only were we similar, our stories are so similar in ways, but we lived, she's like, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Minneapolis. And I'm like, where are you from? I'm from Minneapolis, because I was describing this. Then, right before you hit the symbols, we discovered we live in the same neighborhood.
Yes, thank you.
What struck me was, in addition to hearing about how it affected people then, was learning about how it impacted them going forward, later in life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jay.
I'm just aware that the story that my partner was telling was an invitation to get to know that person better, and to that I wouldn't have thought of approaching this guy walking down there, but now I want to approach him.
A reading. Rebecca Solnit, The Far Away Nearby. Source 1, Apricots, 2014. Stories are compasses and architecture. We navigate by them. We build our sanctuaries and our prisons out of them. And to be without a story is to be lost in a vastness of a world that spreads in all directions like Arctic tundra or sea ice. We think we tell stories, but stories often tell us to love or to hate, to see or be blind. Often, too often, stories saddle us, ride us, whip us onward, tell us what to do, and we do it without questioning. The task of learning to be free requires learning to hear them, to question them, to pause and hear silence, to name them, and then to become the storyteller. The task of learning to be free requires learning to hear them, to question them, to pause and hear silence, to name them, and then to become the storyteller. Sometimes a key arrives long before the lock. Sometimes a story falls into your lap. It's a hot July in New York. It's 2014. And having lived in New York City for just around 4 years, I'm ready to move on. This will be among the final times that I'm going to go up the steps to the Met, being a resident of New York City. I lived on the Upper West Side from 2011, and every Shabbat that I could, I would walk across from 100th Street and West End, for those that know Manhattan on the Upper West Side, where I lived, next to a big synagogue called Anshei Chesed, and I would walk across with a study buddy, a partner, to the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. This was my Shabbat walk. This was my Sabbath walk. And it would take us about 20, 30 minutes to get across the park. And then we'd have to go into the Met, bypassing the attendants seeking to take a donation from us. Oh. Not happening. See, they knew me by now. And when I could on Thursdays, I would go and give the donation to the Met and say, this is my donation for the month. This is my name. I'm Jewish. I'm Orthodox Jewish. I don't use money on Shabbat. Would you allow me in? And they would give me a little sticker. Do you remember they used to have those pins, those buttons? They were metal buttons. They've phased those out now. They gave me a special button. I had my own little button. It's kind of... Yeah, we have to work that one out. But there was a button that I was given, and that button allowed me to go through. So we would go through, and we'd go up, and I always loved the first room, Esther before Ahasuerus, Esther before Xerxes, or Artaxerxes. And this is a huge painting by Artemisia Gentileschi, who lived in a generation after artist Caravaggio in the early 17th century. First female painter of her time, woman painter of her time, who was well known in her own lifetime as a prodigy. Now I'm calling into the space of teaching that Paul gave to us who were gathered here a couple of days ago about what that means in terms of resistance. Resistance, predominant, great man theory of artists. That in the early 17th century, there was someone who was prepared to risk name and reputation in order to show and prove that it wasn't just the dominant white male culture who was able to produce the works of art that would be hanging on the walls of the palaces, of the great palazzos, and all those places where we'd expect to find art. And the first person, woman, who identified as someone who had been oppressed, for in her early years she had been oppressed and abused by someone in her father's workshop, who was prepared to tell that story, proudly sharing her truth with the world, that she was unafraid to say it. And while this is not the story of Artemisia, I want to start with that story, because I didn't know her story at all when I first came to the museum. And it's interesting to me that this idea of resistance to predominant narratives of what art making looks like, that was the opening experience for me at the Met. Mm-hmm. Here it is, up the steps. And here is the map.
Wow.
We're in the Great Hall. We're in the Great Hall, and we are not going to turn right towards the Temple of Dendor. Instead, we are going to go up through the middle, right the way through, up the stairs and down the back, which is the secret passageway, to the American Wing. This is the American Wing. For those that have been there, just hands up those who've been in this space, just so I can get a sense. Okay, great. Okay, so this is the American Wing. And we are going to be looking at a work of art, two works of art, that were juxtaposed in this year, the year that I'm about to take leave of New York, in a special exhibition juxtaposing the wardrobes of two women who never met, who came from very different walks of life, and who had very different views on what it meant to be fully present in their life. As women, as members of society, as individuals, as part of a family, as individuals who were searching, lidrush, searching for a way to articulate who they had become, their life story. One we're going to meet at the earlier part of that story, when she was in her late 20s and early 30s. And the other we're going to meet when she was at the end of her life story, towards the end, in her 80s and 90s. In her 80s, rather, sorry, excuse me. When she was eldering, is a word. When she was eldering. When she was prepared to share that life story with her cousins and with her family. We're going to be joined by the artist in residence, Nate DiMaio. Nate took up residence in that year, although I didn't know it at the time, and I certainly wasn't approaching this room with Nate DiMaio's commentary. I've listened to his commentary, which he calls The Memory Palace. It's a podcast. And for 1 year, Nate DiMaio was at the Met as a podcaster in residence. And what Nate's role was to go to certain works of art and sit with them for a while and see what came up from Nate's own experience being there, rather than all the books that Nate had read prior to attending on this work of art. This is Arabella Warshen Yarrington Huntington's boudoir. This is her wardrobe and place where, her most private place, a place where she would be made up for the evening's events, or where she would retire at the end of the day, or whatever, of doing whatever she was doing, to be at home and be at peace. What an intrusion, one might ask, into the very sanctum, the very sanctuary of a person that is now on display for all to see. However, you should know that she gifted this particular wardrobe and its and all of the items, and gave it to the nation. So in case we were wondering why it is that a person would not be revealed in a certain way that would be uncomfortable for them after their life, just be aware that this was with her permission and with the permission of her estate. We're going to take 7 minutes. This is a writing reflection. I'm going to ask if you can, if you have a pen with you. If you don't, there are pens here. We're going to attend on this together. And attending is a practice that I learned from Maxine Green. Maxine Green began the Lincoln Center Institute as a teacher at Lincoln Center as it was being birthed. Lincoln Center, as you know, is raised above New York City, literally raised above New York City. And the critique of Lincoln Center at the time, and it was a critique that was well taken and continues to be well taken, is that it was literally a place of privilege, a place where people would come to spend a significant amount of money to access culture, capital C. Whose culture? one might ask. And how was that culture being displayed? And how were the threads being woven through New York City up? Well, there were no threads being woven. That was not what was happening at all. And the Teacher Institute that Maxine Green founded, and her book, Releasing the Imagination, Essays on Education, the Arts, and Social Change, was about deconstructing that great edifice called Lincoln Center and making it an access point for learning across the city and bringing the artists that would come from far-flung places to all parts of New York City specifically that wouldn't ever have seen the Lincoln Center that we know today. And of course, we also know the story of how Lincoln Center came to be and what had to go in order for that edifice to be built. And Maxine and her colleagues, they reached in, they searched for meaning in that moment of dislocation, of those who were displaced by culture, capital C, and sought to begin the work of healing between communities that had been displaced by this center. So Maxine Green, Releasing the Imagination. Our practice today is really owing to her leadership. I learned from her for the final year. She passed away in 2012. And I had one experience learning from her. So I am grateful to have met her once in my life. Okay, so we're going to listen to Nate DeMeo. I'm going to switch the lights off. I'm afraid, I do apologize that this is not, it's a bit of a grainy image, but let's see if we can inhabit this as Nate DeMeo takes us through. Okay.
Fiction. Because here's the deal. Arabella was a single teen mom in New York. She had no pedigree. Her father died when she was 9. Her mother ran a boarding house. She had no connections, no entree into polite society, no prospects. She was, in short, the sort of woman who would never get to get dressed in beautiful clothes in a beautiful room like this. Never mind get to build a room like this to her taste, to her whim, in 1881. A room so beautiful it is rebuilt here at the Metropolitan Museum, 140-ish years later. And somehow, she made sure we don't know just how or just when, she met a man named Collis Huntington, a titan of industry who built his vast fortune building the Transcontinental Railroad, who was broad-chested and kind-eyed and married. And somehow Arabella became his constant companion on business trips, at lunch with senators. And people may have raised their eyebrows, but they never raised the issue. Some may have remarked that Arabella's son looked quite a bit like Huntington himself, but they were sure not to remark too loudly. He was merely a philanthropist who had taken an interest in assisting a young widow or an abandoned woman, or whomever she was in whichever story she was telling about her early life. Later in her life, Arabella would become the second Mrs. Huntington, She would become a fixture not just of New York society, but of Parisian society, of London society, California society. She would become a real estate magnate. She would become an important collector of art and of jewelry. She would become a philanthropist in her own right. She would become known as the wealthiest woman on earth. But that was years later. Let's get back to this room, where she used to get dressed, before all of that becoming. Back when Arabella Huntington was still calling herself Arabella Worsham, whether that was true or not. When she, who had come to this town as a teenager, with nothing, no pedigree, no prospects, now had a patron, possibly a lover, and a grand home on 54th Street, she bought with his money, and a vision for that home, and a room of her own, this room, here, where she would put on fine things she once could have only dreamed of wearing. And this woman built this room in 1881. She had a visionary designer, had artisans and laborers, many, many men at her command. She wanted the satinwood, and here is the satinwood, in the door frames and the drawers and the cabinet doors, shipped across the Pacific, hauled across the continent in the backs of railroad cars on tracks likely built by the man who gave her the money to build this room. She wanted cherubs, and here are cherubs, each painted by hand up by the ceiling, or carved by hand here by the door, there, framing the armoire, carved in purple heart, the wood from a flowering tree, felled in the forests of Brazil or French Guiana, and now here in this fine room, for the pleasure of one young woman from Virginia, or Alabama, or wherever she was really from. She wanted butterflies and blossoms, fleeting springtime, and there is spring, forever in the basement beneath the mirror by the window. She wanted flowers, wending vines, climbing the closet doors with her impossible symmetry, twisting and turning in accordance with her wishes into something new and improbable, but seemingly natural and effortless, as though they'd sprung from the soil from mere seed and water and air. Those are silver handles there, on the door, at the sink, sure to tarnish one day, but not tonight, not on this night that I'd like you to imagine now. 1881, 1882. When Arabella Worsham, née Yarrington, not yet Arabella Huntington, not yet 30 years old, would come into this room. From the bedroom, from the door you may have just walked through, and open up her closet of dresses, pull drawers of perfumes and hairpins and pearls, like the ones that hang from the hands of the hand-painted cherubs. And she'd get ready for the evening. She could look out the window that once looked toward Park Avenue, where other fine homes were beginning to rise even taller, but not yet tall enough to block her view of the river and the boroughs beyond, beginning to fill with new immigrants, new arrivals to the city who'd come here with something like nothing, like her, but who were not like her, who hadn't pulled off this trick of building a life out of stories, who weren't sitting in this room on this night, getting dressed for the evening, for the opera, for some fine party with fine people. Someday she would marry a railroad magnate. Someday she would build grand estates and acquire Vermeers and Rembrandts and the only Gainsborough everyone knows. Someday she would crisscross the continent and the Atlantic dozens of times. Someday she would be known as the richest woman in the world. But not yet. On this night, she would get ready for the evening, and she'd step out of this room and into the world.
That's next door. Right around the corner. This is a closet that belongs to Sarah Berman. No one had ever heard of Sarah Berman. Sarah Berman was not of the profile of Arabella Huntington and probably would never have been in the Met were it not for a happenstance meeting in conversation in a street between two people who had connections. This is her wardrobe. This is her wardrobe at home in her apartment on the Lower East Side. This is where she kept her clothes. This is how she kept her clothes. These were the colors, or the color, of her clothing. And later in life, she gave it all away. Everything that she had, almost. She parted from her husband of some 30-something years and remade a life for herself in New York City. And in so doing, she gave away trousseaus full, bags full, of her items and kept only the barest essentials. These are in fact her shoes exactly as they were in her closet. This is what her closet looked like if you were to have walked into her apartment on any given day. The same shirts, the same pairs of trousers, the same t-shirts, and so on. And again, all these items carefully put in place, exactly as they were day after day after day. There isn't an item in there that one would said was a brand name. There isn't an item in there that one would have cared to look at for more than 5 minutes if you had passed by. And how on earth, one might ask, do we find Sarah Berman's closet at the Metropolitan Museum of Art? Because it was here, on the streets of New York, that it was discovered. This is the museum, double M. It was curated by her nephew, actually, Alex, who was a curator, and with her permission, after her passing, she said, if you can find a place for my closet, you're welcome to display it. There's a backstory here, which we're going to share. And he found a place on the streets of New York City. And so, on the streets of New York City, I've seen this myself, as it was, this was free for all to walk past and look into. And if we think about that, the mikdash, right, that sense of something very private, something that was only seen by your eyes, being offered to the world as a metaphor for something. If Arabella Warsham Yarrington Huntington was offering her wardrobe to the world as a metaphor for her life, if Sarah Berman, a Jewish immigrant from Belarus, was now offering and bequesting her wardrobe to the nation as a metaphor for her life, what metaphors were these two women offering? How were they the same? How were they different? Here are the two of them in their 30s. This is Arabella. This is Sarah. Sarah's here in British Mandate, Palestine. And we don't know where this was taken. It's a cameo. It's a small necklace worn as a necklace, a picture. And then it was created as a photograph. Wardrobes built out the stories these women were sharing. I just want to offer a moment of reflection. If you could just flick the lights behind you, I'd be grateful. Given what we have seen and what we have heard, scanning the room from this side on, what are just some reflections that we have of what we have seen and what we have heard? Anything that we notice about visually or audially?
About sharing at the end of her life.
I want to notice as the educator in the space that I'm interested by the quick response to in the scan from our first share, right? There were many people who shared. Now that I have shared this, there was quiet. I'm not saying it was silence, but that I just want to notice that, and I'm asking myself, what was it about that? Yeah.
What I noticed was my own experience, my life experience started to create stories for each of them.
Okay.
Based on what I was seeing, which I had no idea if they're accurate or not, but
okay.
I was in the story making process.
Okay. Gary?
I guess what struck me is that both ladies, in their own way, said, I was here, I matter. This is me.
Let's just do that again, shall we?
Yeah.
Can you see up there? What's going on? What's going on? What's happening here? Yes.
I just, this is Brittany. I sense a secureness as I get older, like a rich picture. It looks like they're just absolutely more secure and free in themselves. Just like, I have a sense of liberation from observing those three. It makes me feel really good.
Kristen.
Yeah, I had to take a moment to process and feel because I was inspired. So I felt simplicity yet so full of depth and richness and voice and spirit and color and vibrancy. Mm-hmm.
Sarah's smile stays the same.
Huh. Do you mind if we go back?
Are these the same two women?
Yes.
Both of them are.
Yeah. It's 20 years progression. Okay. Yes.
Okay. We're both so intentional about everything. It's almost like they're creating their own story. They're creating this, their boudoirs or closets were intentional, their look is intentional.
Just two more, yes, at the back.
The museum exhibits were offered as simply a piece of somebody's life. They weren't created, if you will, in an artistic way. They were just those people's realities, which we don't usually see in a museum. And now that I'm looking at the photograph, which might be considered art, I'm seeing the photographers capture them in a certain way that gives me an impression of them, which may or may not be real, which may or not be as they actually were.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that it's a part of who they were. But the interesting thing to me is that the museum exhibits themselves were a piece of these two women's reality, but they weren't created as a work of art, but they found their way into a museum.
Mm-hmm. To ask any woman, I just wanted to make an observation. It is that in standing before these two wardrobes, I got a strong sense that these two people, these two women, were searching for a kind of freedom from something. And that the stories that they were weaving in their lives were in the service of that freedom. And yet, Arabella acquires. Her story is a story of acquiring. You heard Nate? She ends her life as the richest woman in the known world. And some put her wealth at the same level as Andrew Carnegie's. And so Though Andrew Carnegie would probably have something to say about that. But that was her life. Whereas Sarah, it is clear, was shedding something. Materially shedding, certainly. And the question is, metaphorically speaking, those two arcs, both towards a certain freedom, emancipation, a liberation from something, seem to, like a funicular railway, right, seem to cross over. And I'm interested by the point of intersection between them. They never met. And in my imagination, I imagine this conversation between them in that room, right there, in front of the two wardrobes. And I wonder what would happen if, at this age, as we see them now, they were to sit down together for a cup of tea or coffee at the Met and remark on all those people who are traipsing through with their iPhones and photographing their wardrobes as works of art. And I wonder what would happen if these two people would have met. What different conversation would they have had? What stories would they have told or not told or opted out of sharing? Or just sat that one out, really, because it wasn't so interesting? Would they have been more curious about the experience or not? I'll never know. Walking out from that particular exhibition, I bump into a sculpture that's in the West Wing. It's a sculpture of Ruth. This is the sculpture of Ruth that you will find just outside of that exhibition. And in my mind, I made a connection between the story of the Book of Ruth and these two wardrobes. And now I would like to tell that story. And now I'd like to share, before we share the Book of Ruth, the blessing that is before learning Torah. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech ha'olam, asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed are you, source of all life, who gives us the opportunity to immerse ourselves, to be absorbed, to be present in a practice of Torah that is accessible to all. Right after we say that, as Jews who say the morning prayers, that blessing, there follows an actual piece of Torah. It is source 3. Source 3 says, "These are the things for which there are no measures. The corner of the field that one should leave for those who are without." If you are in an agrarian society, you leave the corner of your field so that those who are without can come and glean there. First fruit offerings at the temple, the pilgrimage offerings, deeds of loving kindness, and the study of Torah. And so this piece of Torah is one that is said every single day, right after we say the words to absorb in words of Torah. And so I think about gleaning at the corners of the field as a practice. Gleaning at the corners of our internal field, at the hinterlands that we've been speaking about, at those edges. And that's what I'd like us to imagine now. Leviticus, source 2. "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap all the way to the edges of your field or gather the gleaning of your harvest." This is deeply related to the sabbatical cycle, deeply, powerfully related. This idea of leaving the entire land for those who can come and take. It is for all. The Hebrew is very clear. It is ownerless. At the end of each sabbatical cycle, the land is to be left ownerless. You do not own the land. All your toil, everything that you have done to caretake the land, is in the service of all. This is the micro of the macro. The pe'ah, the gleaning at the corner, is the micro of the bigger sabbatical picture, which is to leave all. And here in source 4, we join Ruth and Naomi. We're not going to do this inside. We're not going to read the whole, but if you're interested, this is the text. When Naomi and Ruth come into the city, and they are greeted by friends of Naomi from years past, and they say the words, "Hazot Naomi! Can this possibly be Naomi?" You left here looking like you were the richest woman in the world. And you have come back and you look very different. And she says to them, Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but God has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? God has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. That is the story that Naomi is telling at the beginning of the book of Ruth. And the entire learning arc is not of Ruth, but Naomi, actually, ultimately, in this story. Because Ruth is the one who stands in her audacity, in her authenticity, to help Naomi realize herself as a person in society. To understand that she had to release that image of herself, of a certain person with a certain status, and rejoin society as an essential self, not as a constructed self. She had to undergo the process of reconstructing her story, her narrative. I also heard this morning in meditation about narratives that hold us, about stories that hold us, that lock us in. What is it to unravel a narrative that does so? I want to join a younger version of Cynthia Ozick. Cynthia Ozick, the author, is in the living room of her parental home, and this is what she sees. She sees a facsimile, a copy of a painting by Breton in her living room. All her childhood, this is what she sees on the living room wall. And she imagines it to be Ruth. It isn't Ruth. It is someone in a field with a scythe. But for Cynthia Ozick, her imagination immediately takes her to Ruth. And it is the origin story for an essay that she writes in her book, Metaphor and Memory, a beautiful essay that I mean, for me, it was very powerful and impactful. I offer it to you, Ruth, by Cynthia Ozick, which is her own story of articulating her writer's voice in a world that told her that she couldn't write or that she wasn't enough to write. And this motif of Ruth helping Naomi reclaim her own voice that helped her there. Source 6, Cynthia Ozick. But though the picture was its title, The Song of the Lark, there was no lark. It did not come to me that the young woman with her lifted face was straining after the note of a bird who might be in a place invisible to the painter. What I saw and heard was something else, a scene older than this French countryside, a woman lonelier even than the woman alone in the calendar in the calendar meadow. This was part of a monthly calendar, apparently, it turns out. It was, my mother said, Ruth. Ruth gleaning in the fields of Boaz. And the final paragraph. And the harvest is neither hay nor rye. In Boaz's fields outside Bethlehem, they are cutting down barley and wheat. The flowers are there all the same, even if the text doesn't show them. And we are obliged to take in their scents, the weaker with the keener, the grassier with the meatier. Without the smell of the flowers, we cannot pass through the frame of history into that long ago, ancientness behind ancientness, when Ruth the Moabite gleaned. Who wants to stand in front of a facsimile in someone's living room for 5 minutes and look at it? Who wants to stand in front of a wardrobe in your home and look at it for 5 minutes? Who wants to pay $15 for the privilege of walking into your home and looking at a copy of The Song of the Lark, where the lark actually isn't in the picture, with a young girl who's been looking at it for many, many years and who is powerfully impacted by that picture? I do. I do. I want to sit with that girl. I want to sit with that child. I want to see what they see. I want to sit in conversation with that person. I want to sit with Cynthia and ask the question. I never have, but I'm reading the essay thinking, Cynthia, tell me, why was that so impactful for you? It was barely noticed. Your mother was convinced it was Ruth. She didn't even know the painter. She didn't know when it was painted. She certainly didn't know what movement it was painted in. And yet, this was apparently the metaphorical frame that captured your writing voice and that gave you the voice for the rest of your life, which has inspired so many others. I want to know what happened in that story for you. And so Sarah in conversation with her nephew, and I, in the packet, we're not going to go through it in this session, I have taken excerpts of an interview online between Alex Amoya and an interviewer about the museum and about this exhibition, should you want to go further. So in these packets, you will see that there are excerpts from that, and it's available online on YouTube. It's available if you just type in Sarah Berman's closet, you will find it. It's interesting. We're not going to go there today. I would like to go to a source that has made a powerful impact on my life. Oliver Sacks again, source 15. The Joy of Old Age. This was one of the last essays that Oliver Sacks ever wrote. My father, who lived to 94, often said that the 80s had been one of the most enjoyable decades of his life. He felt, as I began to feel, not a shrinking, but an enlargement of mental life and perspective. One has had a long experience of life, not only of one's own life, but others too. One has seen triumphs and tragedies, booms and busts, revolutions and wars, great achievements and deep ambiguities too. And then, at 80, one can take a long view and have a vivid, lived sense of history, not possible at an earlier age. I can imagine, feel in my bones, what a century is like, which I could not do when I was 40 or 60. I do not think of old age as an even ever grimmer time that one must somehow endure and make the best of, but as a time of leisure and freedom, freed from the facetious urgencies of earlier days, free to explore whatever I wish, and to bind the thoughts and feelings of a lifetime together. And here is Cynthia, towards the end of her life, Cynthia Ozick, reflecting in Metaphor Memory. The Book of Ruth, wherein goodness grows out of goodness, and the extraordinary is found here and here and here, is sown in desertion, bereavement, barrenness, death, loss, displacement, destitution. What can sprout from such ash? Then Ruth sees into the nature of the covenant, and the life of the story streams in. Out of the stalk, mercy and redemption unfold. Flowers flood Ruth's feet. Who would have known that a facsimile such as this, hanging out in someone's living room, who would have known that a wardrobe in which all the colours are different shades of white and cream, who would have known that someone who was unknown in New York City society, but whom it was so important to be known, would have the gumption and the verve and the drive towards the apex of the social order of the day? And why? And why is it important for this to be in a museum, alongside these great works that we all know as the masterpieces of the ages? Oh, it's just a wardrobe, I heard someone say. Let's move on. True story. They said this of Sarah Berman. They spent lots of time with Arabella, I can tell you. I was struck sitting there by the conversations that happened in that room. I sat there for half a day on that July. I sat with my friend, taking leave of New York City, and I couldn't have thought of a more apt and powerful exhibition, works of art, as they were, because this was the world of the work of art that Maxine had taught, and Eric Booth, who had learned from her, taught me, that the world of the work of art is actually the human experience, and that the work of art is simply the frame or the mirror that allows us to bring that experience to the fore. Staring at a work of art ourselves, we might not be moved by it, but looking at a work of art with another and sitting there for a time and allowing for what comes up is, of course, the work of chavruta in the Hebrew. It is the work of learning together. Five paintings. That's my rule. I go to a museum, I look at five paintings. Doesn't matter where I go, or five items. Doesn't matter where I go, where in the world, I will not look at more than five. I will spend a minimum of half an hour with each. That's a lot of time. people don't go to the museum with me anymore. Maybe not every time. Maybe not with my boys, who delightfully share with me just how long a person can sit with when they are looking for ice cream or other delights. So this is not the place to talk about bringing children to museum, which is an entirely different practice. But I do want to share with you how, as a parent of three boys, the eldest of whom is 21, 18, 17, Alicia studying Shaya, when I would, here's a Yiddish word, schlep them to museums for my own pleasure, I quickly learned how short an experience that would be, meaningfully for all of us, unless I engaged them in the questions that generated. We saw one item. It wasn't always that easy, I must tell you. But standing here in this room and reflecting with you on what it might mean to walk into a museum with the Sabbath in mind, I can tell you that sitting in front of a painting or a sculpture for half an hour and looking for a maximum, I should clarify, by the way, a maximum of five. That doesn't mean that I was sat for half an hour in front of five things. That would just, yeah. So just, you know, taking time, half an hour. The other day we sat for 20 minutes with a song. I don't know whether anyone in this room were like, oh my, how is that gonna work for me? I don't know what the experience was for everyone in the room, but it seemed that people were present and people were engaged. So we're going to close with that song again. And we're going to bring into that experience, Arabella and Sarah and Ruth and Naomi and the storytelling that covers an arc of a life, and ask ourselves a question. What would happen if someone was to peer inside of our wardrobe at home? What would they find there? Okay, lights please. Comfortable for you, a little bit louder if that's possible. Okay? Thank you for learning with.